Today this is the last section of Lumpo Cha's teaching and training of the nuns community. And this section is called admonishment, which means giving feedback or correcting somebody or giving, instruction that people can be benefiting from. So admonishment. One of the guiding principles of monastic life laid down in the Vinaya is that every monk and nun should make themselves open to admonishment from all other members of their community. But mutual admonishment is not an easy ideal to live up to. In Thailand, the cultural emphasis on preserving social harmony through non-confrontation makes it particularly difficult. Nevertheless, Lumpur would often speak on this topic. So as we were saying, the previous couple of readings, so in the culturally in Thailand, I think Sutisans are the only, there's a few other Thai people. So in Thailand, the cultural norm is non-confrontational, so that you don't sort of tell people in a very kind of straight and sort of face-on way what you think about them if you're upset or angry, but there's ways that you communicate what you're feeling in a sort of roundabout fashion, and so that that is a very, very strong aspect of Thai cultural forms. The process of giving admonishment, and probably there's not so much detail given here about the Vinaya basis of it, is a central part of monastic training, and was established from the time of the Buddha, and he gave a number of teachings, particularly about how to give feedback that somebody might not be particularly eager to hear. And there's a number of scriptural references to that. Firstly, one of the things that the Buddha says is, if somebody offered you a huge pile of gold, or they offer you admonishment, and you have to choose between the two, you should choose the admonishment. The Buddha was very good at coming up with these graphic images. Better to have someone telling you that your speech is inappropriate, or that your attitude is unkind, or is out of balance. Better to be receiving well-intentioned and accurate feedback from somebody else than being given £1 million or £10 million or kind of a pile of gold. So that that sticks in the mind, and the Buddha said, even though the one might be unattractive, is actually going to be of more benefit to you than the sort of a pile of riches. Also, as he goes on to explain in Lumpur Cha's own words, the Buddha established a number of criteria that should be established before giving feedback to anybody. So firstly, you have to have a heart of loving kindness, so you have to be coming from the wish to be of benefit. You're not just, as it said, you're not just venting your spleen or just sort of letting off your own negative feelings when you give somebody feedback, but rather it's for their benefit, not for you. So and sometimes it can be a long wait. I think my record is about 2 years between the moment when I felt I really wanted to say something to somebody and I saw that I wanted him to change for me, not for him. that feeling of, I want you to be different, so I'll be happy. And so it took a couple of years to sort of digest that until it was genuinely for that person, and whatever impact his behavior had on me was secondary to that. But when the moment came, actually sitting right here in the sala, just in that corner back there, and it was a convenient moment, and some things came up in conversation, and it really was for his benefit, not just for me to be letting off my negative feelings. I was able to say, well, actually, that it has been said that you do the same sort of thing, and that people have been very upset by that. And because it was coming from a place of kindness, it was on account of it coming from a place of kindness and well-wishing, he was able to receive that, And to my amazement, I was actually able to say far more and be far more direct and detailed about the things that he'd done and that were upsetting to people than I had even dared in my fantasies, saying, well, when I tell him, I'm going to tell him this. But when it came from a place of kindness, then it was able to be received. If it's coming from, I'm going to set you straight, then, as we know, the door closes. And the wonderful expression they have in Thailand, which is Phang Demairap, which means I hear it, but I don't receive it. So it's going in the ear, but it's not going into the heart. So Phang Demairap. So first one is to have an attitude of loving kindness. Secondly, you have to ask permission to bring a subject up. So like, Venerable Anejo, can I bring something up with you? No. Okay. If the door doesn't open, you can't kick it in. You know, so that if someone says, no, I don't want to talk about it, I know you've got something on your mind, but not today, you know, some other time. So you have to ask permission and receive permission to bring something up. You have to choose a suitable time and place, so not like in the middle of the sala while you're having a Dhamma reading with there's 50 other people around, but you choose a quiet moment where you can talk together without being interrupted and without the other person being embarrassed or shamed or put in a difficult position. So you have to choose the right time and the place. Then you have to stick to the facts. So you can say, well, it was brought to my attention that you said such and such, or I saw that you did such and such, or when I saw you do such and such, then it made me feel like this. So rather than assuming what someone's intention is, or assuming that what you have heard is what actually happened, so you stick to the facts rather than what they call hearsay, like going on what you've heard or what you assume, so that Venerable Isoro, he could be very upset with me because he opens the door in the Vihara and I just kind of give him a nasty look and push straight past him and sort of rush down the corridor. And so Venerable Isoro thinks, oh, Ajahn Amaro, he really hates me, he's really kind of unkind and doesn't like me, and he was very kind of rude the other day, so he could be upset. And you could assume that I hate him, I don't like him, I haven't got time for him. So then, rather than assuming that's the case, then to bring it up in terms of an appropriate admonishment, you say, well, when we met in the doorway the other day, then you looked very upset, unhappy to see me, and you pushed straight past, and so that was kind of disturbing, and it was on my mind for the rest of the evening, and I'm still sort of carrying it around. And I say, oh, I'm terribly sorry, I was just rushing for the bathroom. You were just something in my way, so excuse me. I was in a hurry and I was a bit abrupt, but you know, I had a bathroom emergency. So just making that up. So these are the kind of things. I wasn't upset with you at all. It's just there's something in my way. Great, get past because the bathroom is calling. So you have to speak according to the facts rather than assumptions and hearsay. And then the one of the other conditions is that you need to be free of the same fault yourself. So that's what they call the kicker. So if you're upset with somebody speaking in, spending too much time engaged in casual conversation, you think, well, how much time do I spend in casual conversation? So you have to be free of the same fault yourself before you bring it up with other people. When I would talk about this in California, there was... And it would frequently people would say, can we negotiate on that one? Yeah. Point number five, can we come to some sort of agreement about that? Even though I might not be completely free of anger or impatience or desire or fear, you know, is it okay to raise the subject? So, which I think is a fair enough point, but you have to, in a sense, turn the attention back and say, okay, well, am I seeing... what the faults are in other people because they're my faults as well. As Master Hua one of his frequently quoted statements was, truly recognize your own faults, do not criticize the faults of others. Another's faults are just your own. Being one with everyone is called the great compassion. So that Often what we see and what annoys us and upsets us in others is exactly what we don't like to accept in ourselves. So it's good to turn the camera around and take a selfie, you know, to check and see what's going on within us. So that those are five things, according to the Buddha, to consider in terms of admonishment. So to continue. 1 year during the rains retreat period, Longpo instructed the Meiji community on this principle in detail. By this time, his health was in decline, and he had been unable to visit the Meiji section as often as he had in previous years. He emphasized the importance of each Meiji learning how to admonish themselves as a foundation for admonishing others. They had to learn how to teach themselves, how to take care of their own minds. And this is Longpo speaking. Before admonishing anyone else, you should admonish yourself. Why? Because if you don't, and that person doesn't accept your admonishment, then you may lose your temper. You have to put yourself in a good frame of mind first. Then, if she scolds you or abuses you, you won't let it affect you. You know you've done the right thing. If it's necessary to admonish someone and they take it well, then that's good. But if they don't, then that's their affair, not yours. If the person you admonished criticizes you, then listen to what they have to say. If she says, "You're just jealous of me," ask yourself whether it's true. Investigate it. If it's not, then she's got it wrong, and that's her responsibility. Your practice is to let go, to learn to see everything in terms of Dhamma. Those who received admonishment were to constantly train themselves to be open to the words of others, even if they seemed unfair or inaccurate. Learning how to deal with praise and blame was an essential element of the path to wisdom. Again, Longpo is speaking here. You need to learn how to take responsibility for your speech and actions. Then, if you act with a good intention and you're accused of acting with an impure intention, you can be at ease because you know your own mind. And you know for sure that it's not true. The Buddha taught us to have mindfulness at all times. When you're going to say something, do you have a good intention? What's the purpose of your words? You have to be aware of your actions. Then, when someone says you spoke improperly, you don't get upset because you considered well before speaking those words. You know your intention was good, and the person who says you did wrong is mistaken. You are at ease. Are you as good as they say? You have to know yourself. Don't believe anyone else. Watch out. They say you're bad. That's someone's words. They say you're good, and it's just words. It's not who you are. Only you know that. We come here to let go. If someone gives you an admonishment, then receive it with a sadhu, glad that you're getting it for free. Whether you're in the right or the wrong, listen. It's through listening that wisdom can arise. He illustrated his advice with his own interpretation of a Zen training method. And during these years in the late 60s and 70s, there was a couple of books of Zen teachings that were translated by Ajahn Buddhadasa into the Thai language. So they were the Platform Sutra, the Sutra of Huineng, and also the Zen teaching of Huang Po, who are both Chinese Chan masters of ancient times. And so Ajahn Buddhadasa put those into the Thai language, and Lumpu Cha was very impressed with those. And also he had a few Western students who had studied with Zen teachers before coming to Thailand. This is Longpo speaking again. The Zen masters teach their students to reduce conceit and views. There's not much study involved. If students start to nod while they're sitting in meditation, the teacher hits them on the head with a long stick. Actually hits them on the shoulder. The student says, "Thank you, sir, for being so kind as to hit me on the head with your stick. It reminds me of what I'm supposed to be doing. Thank you, sir." Can all of you Mechis living here thank each other for admonishment? Give it a try. It takes wisdom. If any of you get drowsy during meditation, have Mechi Kampha hit you over the head with a stick, and then say, thank you. Could you do it? Understand this point. Mechi Kampha was the first Westerner to be a Mechi at Wapapong, which is an American woman. She took the precepts with Lumpur in, I think, 1975, and her husband became a monk at the same time, so they had an arrangement for about 5 years. And so Thitapo was over in the Wat Pananachat, and Mechi Kampha was in the nuns' section at Wat Pahpong. The Mechis were to see how valuable it was to receive admonishment, and how fortunate they were to be in a situation where they could receive it. And again, Lumpur speaking here. All of you have an advantage over me. I invite you to admonish me if I do something wrong, but it's difficult for you. Nobody does it, because I'm the teacher, and you don't dare to. That's why practice as a senior monk is so hard. Sometimes the teacher does something wrong, and everyone just lets him carry on doing it without him realizing it's wrong. It's difficult for a teacher to find someone to teach him. But all of you are lucky. If you do something wrong, somebody tells you straight away. It's a really good thing. Don't think negatively about it. Try to see that practice is exactly about things like this. If you let go, if you put something down, it comes to a halt. It's no longer heavy. It is the attachment that is heavy. So on this area, also, one of the aspects that I like to emphasize myself is that the... And it came up in some of these comments of Lumpur about if you people accuse you of things or say things about you and you know that they're wrong, you know, it's their issue. What I've often said is that one of the most refined and important areas of practice is to learn how to be misunderstood. Because my tendency on the personality level is to jump in and say, no, it wasn't like that. Let me explain. So I'm a compulsive explainer. I sort of jump in and try and fix things and make everything all right. And for most of my life, I would just try to not be misunderstood and would desperately try and make everything right and make people see things how I wanted them to be seen. And so I found it very, very difficult to be misunderstood and just to let it alone, just to leave people to think whatever they liked. But that is, I feel, a very, very helpful practice to let people say bad things about you and then to be considering, well, is it true, is it not true? What's behind that? And to allow yourself to be misunderstood and to, say, observe and feel that tendency to jump in and try and fix it or explain yourself. Also, I was very strongly informed by, I think it's a line from the... Analects of Confucius, which is, I'm not sure where it comes in the scripture, but where it says, those who justify themselves do not convince. Those who justify themselves do not convince. So the very energy behind the but it's not like that, it's not like that. The very energy behind that makes someone not believe what you're saying. Or the very place where it's coming from is a sort of desperate, fearful place of self-view and anxiety. And so I've reflected on that a lot over time. And also I would observe others who are quite happy to be misunderstood or the even more subtle practice of being misrepresented. So not just misunderstood, but sitting there while people are saying horrible things about you or saying you did things that you didn't really do and just... keeping stumm, as they say, and seeing how other people could do that, and then and genuinely be quite at ease with it, not being in a state of repression or anger or just like about to explode, but really just completely at ease and realizing, oh, this is a lot to do with the heart being at ease with praise and criticism. And so that I saw that when I was praised or appreciated or approved of, there would be this sort of cat that gets the cream feeling. Ajahn Dhammananda is so wise, he's so kind, so so discerning. He thinks I'm wonderful. But you, people who praise you or kind of appreciate you think, oh, it's... And Lumpur Sumedha would make that kind of... he would go through this and think, oh, he's so wise, so appreciative, so discerning, he thinks I'm great. It's because you're getting approved. You like that person's thing. But then someone who criticizes you or thinks, oh, Ajahn Sumedho, you know, he's really got wrong view and he's actually pretty much a useless practitioner. Oh, how dare you? Who do you think you are? And so Lumpur Sumedha would talk about that in very direct ways and being very honest about his own feelings. And it really struck me like that's a very powerful and important skill to develop, to be able to know praise without getting drunk on it, and to know criticism or without getting drunk or carried away with that either. As Lumpur Cha says here, they say you're bad, that's someone's words. They say you're good, it's just words. And to find that place of ease within yourself where you're not getting carried away with the praise and think, oh yes, actually, I am rather wonderful, aren't I? Yeah. But just say, okay, well, that person is happy about this. Okay, that's their business. Then maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. Maybe there's something worthy of praise here. Maybe there isn't. It's their business. And similarly, if someone's upset, to consider, well, is there something worthy of criticism here or is there not? You know, what is here that is having this effect on people? So I talked about this quite often because I found it was a very rich area of reflection on my own life, and to be misunderstood and misrepresented, which doesn't mean that you just turn yourself into a doormat, because every so often there comes a time when somebody says, oh, you know, for years and years I'd heard that you did this or you thought that, and then I found out I got it completely wrong. I'm terribly sorry. He said, oh, yeah. I mean, you didn't say anything, and I was so kind of rude and critical of you, but you never got upset. Yeah. Okay. So do you feel bad about me now? No. You had your own opinion. You're entitled to that. You can carry that around if you like, and I'm, that you don't have that opinion anymore makes me happy, but I don't feel bad that you had it before. And so that that in that way, you are really independent of those qualities of praise and blame and success and failure, approval, disapproval, so that rather than jumping in to fix things or to explain yourself, just sometimes choosing the right moment or just letting it sit there for a few weeks or months or years. And then when the moment comes, it says, well, actually, you're right. It wasn't that way. It was I was being misunderstood, and then when you're speaking from a place of matter of fact communication of information rather than self defense, it's not coming from a place of self view. It's coming from a simplicity and an honesty, and so then it has a very helpful impact. And so when that's happened with in the past with myself, then the person was. Who is carrying around critical thoughts goes to the other extreme of like, oh, this is so amazing, this is so incredible. You know, I was feeling so negative and saying negative things about you for so many years, and you just didn't get upset. That's incredible. That's wonderful. You're so wise. You're so helpful. That's your business. So that someone else's feelings might go from extreme negativity to extreme faith or praise, but it's equally important to not get carried away with the praise. Like, at last you recognize I'm a fantastic person. Finally you see the truth, and you kind of have the self-view feasting on that. That becomes obstructive in its own way. Does that make sense? So any other... The last section of this chapter is called Dhamma Teachings. So before we get onto that, any questions, thoughts, reflections? Anyone here been... unfairly criticized in the past?
I think I choose a Lumpur Sumedho, in the sense of what I mean, it's kind of humorous, you know. I remember once I took a retreat at the Lumpur Center, and there was a guy, a very nice guy, but he was kind of, people didn't sort of laugh at him, but he was a bit of a character, you know, and you wouldn't see him as kind of an authority on the gentleman type that one would expect. So I did not know who he was talking to me about. So I finished my retreat and I met Lumpur, and he said, I heard there was a really wonderful retreat you just gave. So I said, oh, yeah. He said, do you know, it was Robert who came to me.
I thought you were talking about him.
And it wasn't Robert, it was another name. I can't remember his name, but it was so funny. Because maybe for other people it was quite okay, but for me, in my perception, if I wanted to be praised, it would be somebody special. You know, somebody I considered worth it. Quote unquote. He wasn't one of those worth it opinion that I would cherish. It's so funny. You knew he was doing it a bit on purpose, because Drumpo had a kind of similar, I don't know, he didn't have view particularly, but he had a sense for these things, you know. Who is the important ones? Who are the important ones? And what are not? Right?
So I only want it to be praised by eminent. I only want to be praised by eminent people.
Exactly. So I mean, I'm not saying that about Lumpo, but that kind of mind. You know? I still remember, you know, that.
Yes.
This non-identifying in other people's view. Doesn't risk to fall into a kind of complacency in a way of saying, yes, I don't really care what you think of me.
Yeah, you can.
Where is the tipping point? And how can we define whether we are doing it in the right way or if it's just a yes, you can think whatever you like, don't care.
When it comes to that aspect, often your friends are your best reference point. Greed and hatred are very easy to see because they've got very sharp edges and got highlighted. The raga or dosa and lobha are very easy to see. Moha, delusion, is difficult to see. So there's different ways of approaching it, but often it's your friends, your kalyanamita, that can give you the feedback that you can't see, because delusion is difficult to work. Is the most difficult of the three to work with, because the very means whereby you would recognize it are not available to you, because you're deluded. You're not seeing things clearly, and so that and it doesn't have sharp edges like anger and hatred or greed and passion. So feedback from your friends. So to say, oh, I'm feeling like this. How does that sound? And so a certain amount of self-exploration, like, am I turning myself into a sociopath? Am I just becoming uncaring and numb? What is this? What's going on here? So a certain amount of reflection and internal exploring is helpful. But having conversations with your friends, your kalyanamita, and saying, well, this is what I'm feeling about this. Or actually, just last week, someone had a conversation with me and was saying that other people in his Buddhist group were upset with him, and he's saying, I'm feeling surprisingly okay. And they're upset that I'm not upset. That I should be more disturbed by their negative feedback than I am. So what do you think is going on? So it's exactly that. He was checking in with me to see, like, they're giving me this feedback, they're being critical of me, and they're even more upset because they think I should be upset, but I'm not really. And so then I thought it was very skillful to check in with a friend and say, okay, well, this is going on. What do you think? How does that sound to you? And so you talk it through. And then you can say, okay, well, to a certain degree, yeah, I'm just taking an escape route. You know, I'm sort of playing the all dhammas are empty. I'm playing the Joker. So sort of that outplays all the other cards and say, well, is that valid or is that just my mind being clever? What's going on there? Or am I just sort of shutting myself down because I'm intimidated? What's going on? Or is this just, yeah, I fully accept that, yeah, that certain aspects of my conduct have been painful and upsetting to others. I recognize that. I'm happy to accept that. I'm happy to change my behavior. And my mind isn't making anything out of it. How does that feel? So you kind of walk through it and then see your friends can, what sort of feedback they give to you. Because the practice of Buddha Dhamma is not just to make us numb or into sociopaths, but also it's not to make us sort of hyper-neurotic and sort of an over, what they call hyper-vigilant or over-anxious about getting things wrong or upsetting people, and so that in our effort to do things sort of right, quote-unquote, we make ourselves stressed and upset. There's this collection of Lumpur Cha's teachings that we're doing, reprints of Bodhinyana, Taste of Freedom, Living Dhamma, Food for the Heart, and Everything is Teaching Us, and a book on meditation of Lumpur Cha's teachings. And in one of the questions and answer sessions, so I was looking at these books in the last few days, and in one of the questions and answer sessions, one of the questions is that a Westerner asked Lumpur Cha, "Lumpur, I've heard that you're afraid of your Western disciples." And he said, "Yes, that's right." I said, "Well, why are you afraid of them?" He said, "Because they're too serious. Yeah, you know, you tell them to do something, and they get so uptight, and kind of they sort of lamb into it. They kind of jump into it with a kind of an over. I forget the exact word he uses, but sort of over enthusiastic sincerity, and they cause themselves all kinds of harm because they're being so sincere, and so that." That kind of, checking on the attitude. So it's not just, developing non-attachment or a kind of a coolness of attitude as a sort of program. You have to turn the attention back, say, okay, well, what's the attitude? What's the intention behind this? So I'm letting go of what people say or what people think or the criticism. So in that letting go, I'm calling it letting go, is that what's happening? What's happening here? What's the intention, the chetana behind that? So there's not just the practice that you're doing, but the intention behind it. And so that was generally speaking, and it was addressed a few times in Lumpur Cha's meditation teachings, it wasn't just the particular method of meditation, a particular mindfulness of breathing or loving-kindness meditation or contemplation of death or the body or whatever. He didn't just emphasize the content of the practice, but the attitude with which it's being picked up. And often the attitude with which any practice was being picked up was considered more important than the details of exactly how you did the practice, like whether you focus on your nostrils or your belly or how you should do the walking meditation. So Lumpur Cha didn't stress so much the details of the method, but what's the attitude behind it? What are you taking for granted? What are you assuming? What are you wanting? What are you fearing? And so that, having at least one eye on the intention behind a practice, then that helps to keep things in balance. Because often, if in a way, the more sincere, the more energetic and dedicated you are, the more you're likely to sort of jump in and say, yeah, that's what I got to do. And the mind jumps into the doing of the thing, the system or the practice, and it doesn't notice the intention or the attitude that's behind it. And for things to really work, then there's not just practicing Dhamma, but there's practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. So the fourth of the four factors supportive of stream entry is called Dhammanu Dhamma Patipadaya. So practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. So we can practice Dhamma in accordance with fear or desire or self-view or greed, hatred, delusion. You know, so we can be doing kind of Dhamma-like things, but with the driving force behind it being something that's not helpful at all. Well, like yesterday I was saying, Lumpur Cha's amazing comment to the young Ajahn Sumedho, "You're right in fact, but wrong in Dhamma." That is a really central principle. So, any picking up any kind of practice, like saying, "Okay, I want to learn how to be misunderstood and misrepresented." Okay, that's what I'm going to do. Great, fantastic. I want to do that. And then, okay, wait. Okay, what's the intention behind picking that up? What are the assumptions? What are the hopes? And what's driving that? And then bringing that the initiative or the intention into alignment, in tune with Dhamma, then, so picking up the practice, then it's Dhamma Anu Dhamma Patipada. It's practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, rather than being in accordance with self-view or fear or aversion. Okay, to continue. So this last section of the chapter is called Dhamma Teachings. The Dhamma teachings Lumpur gave to the Mechis were little different in substance from those that he gave to the monks. Although he might emphasize right speech and various community values a little more at the beginning of talks to the Mechis, the essence of the instruction he gave was the same. The more profound teachings were given freely. In fact, monks who accompanied Lumpur when he went to teach the Mechis would say that the talks he gave on these occasions were amongst the best they'd ever heard. So, the nuns got the cream of the crop. A passage in which Lumpur related to the nuns one of his favourite stories gives the flavour of these talks. So this is Lumpur speaking. One of the supreme patriarchs went on a trip to China, where he was presented with a beautiful teacup. The patriarch had never seen anything so beautiful. He started thinking about how he'd show off this gift to all his lay supporters when he got back to Thailand. But as soon as he took the cup into his hands, he started to suffer. Where shall I put it down? Where shall I keep it? He became afraid of breaking the cup. Once the teacup was in his shoulder bag, he constantly reminded his attendant, "Be careful with that shoulder bag. The teacup's fragile. Be careful." It was nothing but suffering for him. The patriarch had been having a good time before that. The suffering began as soon as he received the teacup. That's when it became heavy. Sitting on the plane back to Thailand, he would fret whenever the novice went near the shoulder bag. "Be careful! It's fragile!" If a layperson came close, it was, "Be careful! Be careful with that shoulder bag!" He suffered all the way back to Thailand because he thought that the teacup belonged to him. The suffering came with the attachment. One day, much later, back in his monastery, a novice picked up the cup to have a look at it. The cup slipped through his hands and broke. The Supreme Patriarch exclaimed with joy, "At last! I've been suffering over that cup for years." It's the same with the five aggregates, the khandhas. They're heavy. Throw them away. Throw away form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness. Don't take any of them as self or as belonging to self. They are merely form, merely feelings, merely perceptions, merely mental formations, and merely consciousness, that's all. Don't grasp on to any of them. Seeing their true nature is liberation. We've been attached to conventional realities, but when we see the five aggregates for what they are, then everything flips over, and there's freedom from the conventions. When we put down the burden of the five aggregates, we feel lightness. This is what I'd like you all to understand. Like the monks, the Mechis talked amongst themselves of how Lumpur always seemed to address exactly the issues that they were facing in their practice and wanted to ask him about. As Mechi Bunyu recalled, when he taught the Dhamma, it was clear to them that he genuinely believed in their capacity to liberate themselves from suffering, and he wanted to help them in every way he could. And this is Mechi Bunyu speaking. He taught us to abandon craving, not to attach to an idea of self, to see impermanence. We practiced as he recommended, and we saw the truth of what he taught. I determined to follow his teachings and saw that they were the path to liberation from suffering. He taught us not to be deluded by the physical body, to let go, to abandon attachment, to put things down. I was inspired by his teachings. I fully accepted them and practiced accordingly, and had no thoughts of returning to the world. When he came to give a talk, there were a lot of newly ordained Mechis present. When he came to give a talk, if there were a lot of newly ordained Mechis present, he'd speak on a basic level about not arguing or contending, knowing the meaning of the precepts. On the intermediary level, he'd talk about training to abandon greed, hatred and delusion, attachment to views and conceit, how to practice once our precepts were purely kept. On the highest level, he'd talk about what you'd see and what you'd experience when you'd practiced. He'd talk about the purpose of becoming a nun, about the highest goal of a monastic's life. He would talk about Nibbana and Anatta, and there being nothing worth attaching to. Sometimes he might ask an older Mechi, "Do you know what the state of your mind will be at the point of death?" He taught us to know the knowing in the knowing, a knowing of heat and cold, of pleasure and pain, of day and night, but the knowing in the knowing. So I'll read that last sentence again, just to be clear. He taught us to know the knowing in the knowing, not the knowing of heat and cold, of pleasure and pain, of day and night, but the knowing in the knowing. So that little passage there of about the quality of knowing, this is in the Thai language. They use the expression purul, which also is translated as the one who knows or awareness. So this was a very central theme of Lumpur Cha's teaching, and when he talked about taking refuge in the Buddha, or the Buddha as the refuge, then his usual emphasis, he usually spoke about that in terms of the Buddha that is the true refuge is the awareness of your own mind. So that when he talks about knowing, as she says, it's not knowing heat and cold or pleasure and pain or the ordinary everyday cognizing hot, cold, happy, unhappy, but the quality of awareness itself, because that which knows heat is not hot, that which knows agitation is not agitated, that which knows numbness is not numb, that which knows confusion is not confused. And so that being the knowing, or being that aware, awake quality, was a very central principle, both of Lumpur Cha's teachings, also within the forest tradition generally. And so that would be part of the emphasis of the teachings. And then Mechi Bunyu is using that expression to know the knowing in the knowing, so to be that quality of the Puru, being that awareness itself. And then lastly, the duty of a samana. On one occasion, while addressing the Mechis, Lumpur returned to an old and potent theme: how to make the most of monastic life, how to live as a true samana. Progress in Dhamma began with the cultivation of a sense of urgency. Lumpur is speaking here. The days and nights are relentlessly passing. That's what it says in the books. What are you doing right now? What does it mean to you to be a Mechi? If you say that you come to abandon defilements, then do you know what the defilements are? Can you recognize the unwholesome qualities in your mind? Are you abandoning defilements? Are you resisting them? What are you thinking right now? What are you doing? Are you thinking wisely or foolishly? Are you thinking jealous thoughts or angry ones? Is there desire in your mind? Examine the present moment. Lumpur said that now that they had left the lay life, the Buddha was asking them questions. He was asking, are you conducting yourself like a samana yet? Are you speaking like a samana? Do you eat like a samana? He warned them against living heedlessly. Living too comfortably was an obstacle to practice. He said that the way of a samana is to put constant effort into abandoning greed, hatred, and delusion. It's through that effort that the samana earned the respect and support of lay Buddhists. But if lay Buddhists did praise their practice, they should treat those words of praise with caution. If they were not true, then after hearing those words of unearned praise, they should put forth the effort to become worthy of them. Lumpur said that the reason people don't let go of defilements is that they haven't seen the suffering inherent in them, and so are reluctant to abandon their attachment. Greed, hatred, and delusion arise in our minds because of our wayward thinking. A person with wrong view will not find peace even in the most conducive environment. Wrong views always bring suffering in its wake. Wrong view always brings suffering in its wake. Only right view leads to peace. Peaceful states of mind developed in one holding wrong views will never lead to wisdom. Only the calm informed by right view can support insight into the way things are. He stressed that it is right view that enables a samana to know how to adapt, to know how to live in a large community, how to live in a small community, how to live alone. When right view has been developed, living in a large community feels no different from living alone. The harmony of the group is vital. It's a supportive factor for practice. Chanting together, meditating together, working together, all foster the harmony of the group. When other mechis act poorly, he said, then be aware that this is because their Dhamma practice is not yet strong enough to overcome their defilements. Some have deeply ingrained bad habits. They've never created the conditions for wisdom and letting go in the past. Make allowances for them. Then lastly, Lumpur is speaking here. You've still got defilements. You've still got craving. So you try. You increase the number of practices you've taken on. You examine your body, speech, and your mind every day. Where are the shortcomings? You extend the bits that are too short, and whatever's too long, you cut it off. So that's the end of that chapter. So this principle of the reason people don't let go of defilements is that they haven't seen the suffering inherent in them, and so are reluctant to abandon their attachment. Again, that's a very, very frequent theme of Lumpur's teaching, that he said, you know, that it's only when you know the pain of attachment that was when we'll let go. Approaching our attachments with reason or with determination, that is often and usually is not enough to really work with them effectively. It's that genuine appreciation of, because of this attachment, this clinging, there is this pain, and really knowing that pain, that's what makes us let go. So that someone can say, that's really hot, don't touch it. But it's only when, ow, that painfulness is what causes us to really withdraw the hand. So that's a very simple principle, but an extremely a potent one in terms of the practice, and particularly if the habits of self-view and negative thinking jump in, so that maybe if we say something that is unkind to one of the monks, or we have too much food to eat at the mealtime, or we are sort of jealous of somebody's really nice Wellington boots they've got when ours are kind of wearing out or got not quite the right colour, or we can feel jealous or unhappy about some thing that we own, and we can say, oh, it's just a pair of Wellington boots, why am I so upset, it's so stupid, I never even cared about my clothes before I came to the monastery, and now I'm jealous because this nun's got really nice boots and I haven't, and I'm such an awful person, I'm so shallow, I'm so weak, I'm so horrible. So that is where the recognition of a negative mind state, say feeling jealous of something somebody else has got, that gets taken over, hijacked by self-view, and that recognition of that unskillful mind state, then it becomes more, it makes more obstacles, it makes more confusion and more suffering because of that. So that recognizing the pain of attachment, part of what I see for myself, and I often talk about, is that the more wordless that recognition can be, like I'm attached to this other person's clothing, or I'm annoyed by that person's behavior, I feel regret about my own, wrong speech. So the more wordless that recognition can be, the better, I would say. That just having said something that was unkind or unfair, when it's remembered, ow! And many of you all have heard me talking in this way many times before, but just to let it stay with the ow, and not add anything to it, not ow, therefore I'm a terrible person, and I've been doing this my whole life, and I'm incurable, and this is a terrible problem. And that almost invariably, the more the thinking mind gets hold of it, the more it creates complication, and so with that complication. And it gets sort of tangled up, so that the painfulness, that emotional pain of hiri otapa, gets tangled up and covered over with all of that self view and I should and I shouldn't and I must and I, in the future I'm gonna, and even though it's well intentioned, that proliferation, that entanglement of thinking around that feeling, makes it unhelpful. So for Hiriyotapa, that painfulness of recognizing unskillful action or speech or thought, what makes it helpful is just to leave it as uncomplicated as possible. Just, this action happened, ow. Just let that pain be felt, and it will have its own effect. You don't have to add a whole story to it. You don't have to add a me who should be like this or shouldn't be like that. Rather, just let that pain, that painful feeling, have its natural impact. And then when a similar situation comes around and you get tempted to bend the truth for the sake of a good story, or you're looking to find a new pair of boots or something, then you remember that painfulness. It's like the body remembers. And so rather than I should, I shouldn't, I must, I said I would, I said I wouldn't, which creates more complication generally, they're just that... The simplicity of the recognizing and fully acknowledging that painfulness of attachment, of grasping, that's the liberating agent. So that's why the Hiriyotapa, so moral sensitivity, so the wise sense of conscience, the painful feeling that comes from recognizing, I said something that was unkind or unfair, shouldn't have used Venerable Isoro as an example, and that he's still feeling bad about that, and maybe he thinks that I do really not like him, and or maybe that was poorly done. Just making that up again, just in case. So that the recognition of the painful feeling of something that's been done in the past, which is hiri, and then otapa is more related to consequences. I've seen that other consideration of, if I do this, then that's going to be the result. If I follow this greedy impulse, then it's going to have this consequence. Or if I act in that harmful way, then it's going to have this consequence. So that otapa is more about the wise fear of consequences, and hiri is more about the wise recognition of the effects of bad, unskillful, unwholesome conduct in the past. They're not entirely that way, but roughly. Hiri is relating to the past, otapa more to the future. Hiri more inside and relating to this person. Otapa is also related to the unskillful actions of others that we see. So that when you see someone else acting in an unskillful way, someone is greedy or is dishonest or is destructive, that sense of, ooh, the kind of the recoiling in the heart when you see someone else's actions is also in the otapa category. But anyway, the more that we can just let Hiriyotapa function, then they're painful mind states. But that's how they work. And so they're called the bright protectors. They are the guardians of the world. So that they're the two devas, as I was mentioning the other day, the two devas either side of the temple doors, one with a blue halo and one with a red halo, that they represent Hiri and Otapa. They're brightnesses. They're bright qualities of the heart. They're the bright protectors. They're not the kind of the knife in your heart, the kind of the unforgivable pain in the depths of your being. That Hiri and Otapa, they are a brightness of the heart. So that when we recognize the that quality, that pain of attachment, that's what helps to let go. And also, that letting go is not me letting go because I should let go, but rather just like that the hand pulls away from the hot stove. There's a non-personal quality to that. It's not I should, therefore I will do this, but rather the letting go just happens by that falling away. The heart loses interest in that thing. It just doesn't want to tell lies. Doesn't want to be dishonest. Doesn't want to be greedy. It just sort of falls away on its own. So, in a way, letting go is not quite the right word. It's more like a a relinquishing or an abandoning, like a you know, the leaves fall off the trees in the autumn. They're just, the tree isn't sort of consciously letting go of the leaves. It's just the leaves have had their day and they just fall off on their own. So that the unskillful habits of greed, hatred, delusion, and such like, they fall away through the power of that quality of awareness and the impact of the of Hiriya and Otapa. Any questions, reflections?
I often recognize how easily I get manipulated by my choice of words. I say to myself in the head, when bad things happen, I could have said just, it was unpleasant, but I say to myself it was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I create lots of bigger, more horrible things in the head. And then so when I recognize it was my choice of word that started the whole drama in my head, it kind of helped me to let things go, a little bit helpful to understand how this a linguistic area in
mm-hmm.
my head.
Very good.
Yeah, so sometimes because I can see that I use lots of exaggerating words a lot
mm-hmm.
in my head. Horrible or really nasty or
mm-hmm.
Unacceptable mm-hmm. or that words, when I recognize it, what kind of words I usually use, I can see that, but these words maybe make really bad things in my mind,
mm-hmm.
and that make things really going on and on and on, more than it's necessary. So it helped me a lot to think like that.
You're not alone. So again, Lumpur Samedha would often talk about that, exactly that. He would hear himself saying, "That's unbearable," and he'd realize, "No, it's not." Well, that's fantastic. He said, "Not really. It just means I kind of like it. That's all." And that his mind would think in these hyperbolic, the over extravagant, exaggerated language, and he would just recognize, well, I'm telling myself that's terrible, but it's not. Terror does not really arise in relationship to this. It's just a mild feeling of dislike. Yeah. But then the mind says, it's terrible weather. Yeah. And then, well, no, it's not really. And that's quite just that which is recognizing that exaggeration is the thing to trust. Very good. And it's a very common habit that we tell ourselves, we have particular themes or ways we talk to ourselves, the way we describe things to ourselves. And the more that we can recognize, well, that's what I say to myself, I tell myself that story, but is that the case? Or one particular insight that Dumpo had about being unbearable was that I think was really a very big turning point for him in his meditation was, in his early years at Wat Bopong, and it was one of those sitting in the hot season, sort of soaking with sweat in his robes, about hour three or hour four of a long Dhamma talk on a one prat night, and being uncomfortable and sweaty and being eaten by mosquitoes, and his mind saying, I can't bear it, I can't bear it, I can't bear it. And then he had this insight, which was, even as my mind is saying, I can't bear it, I'm actually bearing it. So that my mind is saying one thing, I can't bear it, but it's not true. I'm bearing it, even as I'm thinking I can't bear it. So those thoughts are lies, they're not true. And it was he's mentioned that many, many times in Dhamma talks, and it was a big insight for him, because we tend to assume that what our thoughts are saying is somehow true or connected to reality. But in that moment, he realized, that's not true. this inner voice is saying, I can't bear it, but what's that got to do with anything real? And that was a big breakthrough for him. Okay, we can leave it there for today. The next, I'll hop forward again. My plan, insofar as plans for the future have any value, is that there's a large section called A Broader Canvas, which is the account of Lumpur visiting the West in 1977 and 1979. So that would be my aim, is for the last few weeks of the retreat, we'll look at Lumpur's visits to England and France and the States in the 1970s, and as that very much involves this place and our community. So that's my plan for the last batch of readings for this retreat time.